Maybe not everybody knows that I'm planning to spend quite a few months here at Perimeter. Starting now, I'm on sabbatical, and until the end of May, I'll be here about two-thirds of the time. And my office is on the fourth floor in that wing over there. So the topic here, actually, I'm going to speak about several different projects that I've worked on in the past couple of years with students, Batul Bani-Hashemi at Maryland, who's just graduating this year, and Andy Svesko, who's a postdoc now in London, and Manus Visser, who's also he's a postdoc at Cambridge right now. The way I got in, so this is pretty much about de sitter space and similar things. And it wasn't a topic that I was particularly into earlier. I spent a lot of time thinking about black holes, but not much about de sitter space. But one peculiarity about the thermodynamics of de sitter space puzzled me a lot, which was a minus sign. It looked like maybe the de sitter static patch had negative temperature, which seemed very weird, and I like weird things, so I dove into that. For a while, I thought it had negative temperature, but I don't anymore. And in fact, it's now I think it's a non-issue. And one of the things I'll explain to you is why it's a non-issue. But that's not the main focus of the talk. The title refers to the last part of the talk, which I actually feel like is the most exciting part. But on the other hand, I thought it'd be good to share with you a few other things that we've gotten into over the past couple of years. So that's the general idea. The references that the talk is based on are these, which I guess will be available in the recording, so I won't pause. So it all starts with this Gibbons and Hawking paper from, well, it's 1977, but received in March of 1976, very shortly after Hawking's discovery of Hawking radiation from black holes. Gibbons and Hawking recognized that the role of the event horizon in black hole physics was very similar to the role of an event horizon in de sitter space. And in fact, in this paper, they didn't restrict even to de sitter space. They talked very generally about any event horizons. I won't go into how they generalized it, but I invite you to look if you're curious. Anyway, the key sentence in the abstract is that an observer in these models will have an event horizon whose area can be interpreted as the entropy or lack of information of the observer about the regions which he cannot see. Well, actually, I don't even agree with this statement, I think. It's true that if the state of physics and space-time is pure and you partition a system, well, if the state of a system in quantum mechanics is pure and the system is partitioned into two factors of Hilbert space, then there's a reduced entropy on one side and also on the other side, and those two entropies are equal, just algebraically, it's automatic. And so you could think of the entropy as the missing information about what's on the other side that you don't see. But I don't think that's a good way to think about entropy, because the relevance of entropy in thermodynamics is really for what you do see. It governs the way things can develop and interact in your domain of experience, which would be on your side of the horizon. In any case, it's not an important distinction for the talk, but I just thought I'd proselytize for a second there. So it started here with they're talking about, in particular, de sitter horizons. And one of the things they did in the paper is derive like a first law of horizon thermodynamics that applies to not just de sitter, but actually Kerr de sitter. This is a picture of Schwarzschild de sitter, which is spherically symmetric, so it emits a simpler, a simple Penrose diagram in two dimensions. So this is the Penrose diagram of Schwarzschild de sitter. This is a future null infinity that's space-like in the de Sitter-like region. And inside here is a region bounded by a cosmological horizon on this side and a black hole horizon on that side. Here's the singularity at r equals zero inside the Schwarzschild-like region. And they derived a first law that relates the variation. It applies to this red diamond here, and it relates to variation of the areas of these two horizons and the angular momentum of one horizon relative to the other horizon, and the variation of any matter stress energy inside the diamond. So here's the stress energy tensor of matter. Ka is the Killing vector that generates the cosmological horizon. So it would be a combination of a rotation and boost that's the tangent to the horizon generators there. So you get a term for each horizon area with its corresponding surface gravity, and then an angular momentum term, and then this energy momentum variation. Another little comment I just wanted to make here. I think there's a missing term in their equation. If they're considering the case where you start with a background stress energy tensor that's not zero, if this represents a variation of empty Kerr de Sitter, where you add some matter, well, then this term would be zero because the background stress tensor would be zero. So this variation of the metric would be multiplied by zero and you wouldn't have anything there. But they were appealing to the famous Bardeen, Carter, and Hawking first law, which was derived for variations of a black hole in equilibrium with matter outside, let's say a rotating accretion disk, for example. And so they derived a variational relation. And in that case, the background stress tensor is not zero, so you would need this term. So I don't know why Gibbons and Hawking didn't comment on this, but I do think it's a missing term. In case you're into this details of this kind of thing, just be aware that that should be there. It's discussed in the paper that Manus and I wrote on causal diamonds about 4 years ago. But it's also, there's a detailed analysis, a redo of the Bardeen, Carter, and Hawking by Vivek Iyer, who was Bob Wald's student, applying Wald's another charge methodology to derive the first law when you have a fluid source of matter, fluid matter. And he also recognized the role of that term. Anyway, what I'm really going to focus on is the case where instead of having these black holes, we just have this de Sitter piece in the middle. And then the Penrose diagram truncates to this. And the left-hand side of the picture is the center of one de Sitter static patch. And this is the center of the antipodal de Sitter static patch. And then all the terms in this relation drop out except for the one involving the variation of the area of the static patch.
Sorry, can I ask? So
sure.
Missing term, you're saying if we have fluid, additional fluid in the picture, that doesn't change the geometry, but is there static?
Fluid or, yeah, any matter, but in the background. So if the relation is a variation away from a solution that has matter in it already, then that term would contribute. Anything else? Okay, so just all I've done here is just drop all the terms that refer to the black hole horizon. So this term goes away, there's no angular momentum of the black hole. And so all we have is this cosmological horizon area variation and this term. And I'm just dropping that, assuming there's no background.
Can I just ask us, I mean, in de Sitter, you do have a TAB, right? It's the cosmological constant. So, I mean, maybe it's just obvious why that would be zero, but.
Actually, we've got a detailed explanation of that in the paper. I just have to remember what happens. Wait a second. Shoot, I'm not remembering right now, but let's discuss it afterwards. There's a simple explanation. Sorry about that. Okay, so the thing I want to focus on for the moment is this minus sign. So this is peculiar if you think about, if you try to think about the static patch as a kind of thermal system in equilibrium at the de Sitter temperature, which you would have thought the Gibbons-Hawking temperature of de Sitter space. You add some killing energy to the static patch here, this red triangle. And you would think that if you add energy to a thermal system, the entropy should go up. But this minus sign says the entropy goes down. So why would it go down is the puzzle. So one idea is it goes down because the temperature is actually negative. This was actually proposed by Clem and Vanzo quite a number of years ago. And Manis and I, in our paper, thought it was a good idea and we pursued it. And that actually, trying to understand it is what got me into everything else that I'll tell you about today, which is thinking more about de Sitter space. But just really quickly to say why it's not negative temperature and it's a non-issue. A similar minus sign actually appears in the black hole case, but you're just not used to thinking about it. Namely, if you add matter killing energy outside the horizon of a black hole, but you hold the ADM mass fixed, then some of the what that means is that some of the ADM mass comes from the black hole and some comes from the matter. And since you added matter energy in, less of the ADM mass is coming from the black hole. And therefore, the black hole is smaller and its entropy goes down. So to put it differently, the only energy that's thermalized is the part that's corresponding to the black hole or the horizon. And just energy outside of a black hole might be in a perfectly non-thermal, you know, pure state, and it shouldn't contribute to the entropy. So you always subtract, in the case of a black hole, the killing energy outside of black hole, that variation, from the overall ADM energy. Now, in the case of de Sitter or the static patch, there is no ADM energy because there's no boundary at infinity. So it's as if the ADM energy is just zero. So if you add in killing energy, you're adding in something positive to something that should stay zero. So you must have correspondingly added something negative to cancel it. Therefore, the horizon area decreases. I'll come back to this and explain it in equations later, but that's the basic reason why that minus sign is actually expected. Another way to put it, maybe I should have said this first, you know, it's true that in thermodynamics, the total internal energy variation of a equilibrium system is related to the entropy variation. But the appropriate concept of total internal energy for the de Sitter patch is not the killing energy of matter. It's actually the zero energy that's associated with the absence of a boundary. Let's see, the other point I wanted to make is, the other interpretation of the minus sign that relates to what I'll talk about later was proposed by Banks. Well, it's a combination of Banks and Fischler from a long time ago, 22 years ago, and a Banks, Feil, and Morrissey interpretation. So what they were saying was, Banks and Fischler said, you should think of the de Sitter entropy of the static patch, which is the area divided by 4 of the de Sitter horizon, as the logarithm of the dimension of the total Hilbert space of the static patch. And correspondingly, that empty de Sitter space corresponds to a maximally mixed state. This is a very strange concept also, because it doesn't look like everything is there, but I'll come back to it. In any case, these guys proposed the interpretation that if you add matter killing energy to the static patch, then you no longer are talking about a maximally mixed state. You've imposed a constraint on the space of all possible states. Namely, you're only talking about states that have some particular matter energy there. Therefore, you've restricted the Hilbert space to some subspace. So therefore, the dimension of that sub-Hilbert space should be smaller. And that's the interpretation of the minus sign that these people proposed. And it actually, what I'm going to tell you about seems to support that interpretation. But to actually understand it and feel confident, we need to just not just manipulate variational formulas that are essentially classical, but go back to the level of quantum statistical mechanics, identify the ensemble that we're talking about, and then maybe that will lead to a better understanding of what this entropy refers to.
So Ted, I thought this resolution this was to add the PDB term. Maybe that was the first thing you were talking about.
Add a PDB?
Because, I mean, if you have pressure, there's a, I mean, the first law of thermodynamics as a PDB.
Wait a second, I don't even understand. I can't add a term. The equation I wrote is correct.
No, but I'm saying that thing, it's temperature TDS is not the only thing. I mean, you shouldn't interpret that as temperature. This is a combination of PDB and TDS term. First law has DE, PDB, and TDS, right? So if you want to map that to the first law, you have to add the pressure term as well.
Yeah, I don't think that's the right interpretation.
Okay.
Bring it up again when I show in more specifically what I think is the interpretation. So we want to identify the ensemble. And for that, we go to the next paper of Gibbons and Hawking, the same year, 7 months later or something. And this is the one, this is the one on action integrals. So they actually define a quantum statistical partition function for gravity inside a region with a boundary, with some boundary values defining an ensemble, and then evaluate the partition, well, express the partition function as a path integral formally, evaluate it by a saddle point approximation, and extract this classical laws and semi-classical laws of horizon thermodynamics. Now, one of the things that I did with Batul is go back and look at this carefully, which I'll tell you about next, but I guess I just really, I think I just stated what's on this slide, so I can probably skip it. They defined a grand canonical partition function. It's defined by parameters, temperature, angular velocity, electric potential, and the temperature is defined by a Euclidean time period, that's 1/1 the temperature. Okay, this is what I wanted to say. For De Sitter space, they just took the saddle point approximation to this, which was, the whole thing was set up for black holes. And then they just said, okay, let's apply it to De Sitter space. Since De Sitter space is closed without any boundary, we should just set these charges, mass, angular momentum, and electric charge to zero, and just interpret the log of the partition function as just the entropy, because there's no energy term. So I always found this manipulation is done at the saddle point only. So they don't tell us what ensemble they're computing an approximate value of. They just take the formal expression for the path integral. In fact, not even for the path integral, for the saddle action, and just set M, J, and Q to zero in it. And they get an answer that looked reasonable. So I want to understand better, what are they really calculating here? What is the partition function? What's the ensemble? How was the temperature specified if the space didn't even have a boundary? Normally, the temperature is a period of a Euclidean time, but we don't have any period to refer to, except at the saddle. The saddle itself, in this case, is a round sphere, which has a certain circumference around an equator. But that's a property of the saddle, not a property of the ensemble. So what is the ensemble? So to try to address this, or to address this, what we're going to do is introduce a boundary artificially, which we call a York boundary, because Jim York first introduced these artificial boundaries outside black holes in order to define ensembles that include black holes when you don't have when you can't use asymptotic infinity or something to have a physically suitable boundary. So we're going to introduce the boundary, but then take a limit where the boundary disappears. So before the boundary disappears, we'll know what we're talking about, and then we'll just see what we're talking about. We'll learn what we're talking about by taking the limit where the boundary goes away. So here's a little review of the Gibbons-Hawking partition function methodology with a little bit of critique. It was first introduced in the paper I showed you. The approach we're following here was introduced by York and Whiting and York a really long time ago, restricting to the spherical sector and trying to interpret the half integral a little more precisely than Gibbons and Hawking had. And then many people in intervening decades have also dug into this a lot, including finally recently, Batul and I, because I guess personally, I still didn't understand what was going on and what was justified or what wasn't justified. So briefly, here are a couple of ingredients that you should be aware of if you're going to try to take this kind of calculational scheme seriously. We start, like always in quantum statistical mechanics, with, for example, a canonical partition function. H is the Hamiltonian, beta is the inverse temperature, and the Z is the trace of that operator. And for gravity, H is an integral over a space-like slice of lapse and shift times constraints, plus, if there's a boundary term. So to write this as a path integral, we write this exponential as a product of its nth roots and introduce complete sets of states. But those complete sets of states should be states in the Hilbert space of quantum gravity. So they should be constructed out of the reduced phase space for gravity. In other words, I don't want to introduce gauge degrees of freedom in these complete sets of states. I want a unitary expression for this trace. It's really important that the trace is counting actual states. So what Whiting and York insisted on was that we should use a reduced phase space description of the degrees of freedom and then insert complete sets of Q and P states in the reduced phase space. Okay, then but that doesn't look anything like what Gibbons and Hawking had, which is what I've written in these red quotes here, which is just a path integral over all metrics, e to the minus Euclidean action. It's known that, you know, this can't actually be the right expression. One reason is that the action is unbounded below the Euclidean action. And so this is clearly not the right answer. So what's really going on? What is the meaning of this expression, and why did it, what Gibbons and Hawking did, like, appear to make sense? So to get from here to there, we impose the constraints because we're working on the reduced phase space. We write the constraints as Fourier, as delta functions written as Fourier integrals over some like Lagrange multipliers that act like lapse and shift. And then we can integrate out the momenta completely because the conjugate momenta in gravity only appear quadratically in these constraints. So it's just Gaussian integrals. You get rid of the momenta, they get set equal to what Einstein's equation would have said they were equal to. And so then we get they get replaced by time derivatives of the spatial metric. But we still don't have an expression like this because the lapse and shift Lagrange multipliers in imposing the delta function were multiplied by I. They had I in front, right? A delta function is e to the I x integrated, e to the I lambda x integrated over lambda is delta of x. There's an I before lambda. But here there's no I before n in the boundary term. And it's certainly not an I before a Euclidean action. So to get to this expression, we have to imagine that it's possible to deform the contour of integration over the Lagrange multipliers. It's clear that we can't deform it completely, like totally rotate it everywhere, because if we could, we'd get to an expression like this, and we know this isn't right because the action is unbounded below. So really all we're saying is that we could hypothesize that the contour can be deformed such as to go through a saddle that is described by a Euclidean metric, and that this Euclidean action will capture the contribution at that saddle. But it's not that we really had a Euclidean path integral to begin with. Okay, and that action has this form. It's the Einstein-Hilbert action. I've written it in four dimensions here. I'm restricting to Einstein gravity, so neglecting higher curvature terms. This is like in the context of a low energy effective field theory. That's already raising an interesting puzzle. If you're trying to count states in quantum gravity, why should it be possible to restrict to the low energy effective description? Isn't the count of states related to high energies ultimately? I think the answer to that is it's because Newton's constant reflects the UV sector of the theory. It characterizes the ultraviolet degrees of freedom. So you don't have to explicitly take them into account as long as you're using the correct value of Newton's constant. By the way, Newton's constant doesn't appear in this equation because I'm using Planck units.
I'm sorry, but isn't that kind of morally assuming that you can renormalize using G as a running coupling constant for the theory somehow, which is by definition in contradiction with non-renormalizability of gravity?
Actually, it's not in contradiction with it. I mean, are you familiar with, I mean, general relativity can be quantized as an effective theory with an energy cutoff that prevents the Planck scale physics from completely changing the story.
Yeah.
So the idea here is that if you're just counting the accumulated effect of all of the states in the microscopic theory, but in a background that's got low curvature and has a horizon, then it's sufficient, then that count is captured by the low energy effective value of G, which has run through all kinds of stuff that we haven't discussed in terms of normalization group flow, but eventually has some value at low energy, which in effect summarizes all that microscopic physics. I like to think of the analogy with elastic constants.
Okay.
You know, if you try to say what determines the elastic modulus of a crystal, ultimately it's atomic scale physics. But if you know, if you measure that elastic constant, it's a perfectly good summary of how much energy it takes to change the size of a crystal or something like that. So I see it as strictly analogous. Okay, so that's the background. I won't go into this very much. There could be a whole talk about the details of this, and that's not what I want to focus on today. What I want to talk about, though, is what, if you take this as the starting point, restrict to the spherical sector, but allow for cosmological horizons. Don't, unlike Whiting and York and the following groups, in fact, York collaborated with many other people on generalizing this to other kinds of black hole settings, and other people have, always restricting to spherical symmetry, sometimes including angular momentum. So what is added by including a cosmological horizon as a possible horizon? What does it mean to include it? It really just means that, unlike the black hole case, where here's the boundary and the black hole is inside, inside means that the area of the black hole horizon is smaller than the area of the boundary. So we want to also consider the opposite case, where the horizon is bigger than the boundary. And that's included in the same ensemble. If we're talking about a canonical ensemble, we've specified a temperature at the boundary, but we haven't said whether the horizon is bigger, if there's a horizon, whether it's bigger or smaller than the boundary. So both cases are included. So let me show some pictures of what those cases could be and describe the stationary points of the action that correspond to those configurations. Actually, I think I might have skipped one here. No, I didn't, yeah. So here's the first one, is just the almost like a flat space ensemble. So here's my boundary, this dashed line. To specify the ensemble, the size of the boundary R is specified, say the area radius, and the temperature at the boundary, or the inverse temperature beta. And you could fill in the boundary with just empty space, no horizon at all. If there's a cosmological constant, what you're filling it in with is a patch of de Sitter space. We call that hot thermal de Sitter if there's a cosmological constant. If the cosmological constant were zero, it would be what was called a Gross, Perry, and Yaffe hot flat space. The term hot, you know, how could flat space be hot, or why is it thermal de Sitter and not just de Sitter? It's because you could periodically identify, that is, you could define the temperature however you want. Here's a picture of how it works in the case of de Sitter. So in a two-dimensional de Sitter cartoon, the exact Euclidean de Sitter solution would be just a sphere. And a boundary is a ball there, and a ball in two dimensions is just just a pair of points. That is, a zero sphere is a pair of points. And the space inside the sphere is just this line segment. So that's what corresponds to the system inside there. And now the time direction goes around like transverse to that. And if it's exact de Sitter temperature, well, then the band I've drawn here should just be an equatorial band around the sphere. But there's no reason I couldn't identify with some other period. And that would define what we're calling thermal de Sitter space. It could be a shorter period than de Sitter, in which case it's hot de Sitter space, or it could be a longer period, then it's cold de Sitter space. Yeah.
So I'm just trying to understand your picture on the left, because I think when I look at it, I'm probably looking at it and interpreting it from a spatial point.
That's right, yeah, I should have said.
I'm imagining, like, I've got my cosmological horizon out of the Hubble, it's radius, and then I've got this spherical system. But then,
right,
when you go to the bottom right-hand picture, you're now stepping up to your Euclidean de Sitter, which is presumably the two spheres. So
that's right.
I'm a bit confused by what is time? You know, is it what's on the left?
Yeah, thank you. So it's exactly what you said. This is like one time slice picture. And in here, that would correspond to just this one slice here. What's shown here as the thermal time circle is not shown at all in that picture. But what I wanted to illustrate here was just that if I do extend that through time, through the Euclidean time dimension, I could periodically identify with any period I want, even though the system inside is a piece of, it's exactly locally the de Sitter solution, Euclidean de Sitter solution. I'm not forced to identify it with the de Sitter period.
Yeah, why is that? That's what's confusing me. I mean, isn't it the usual conical singularities unless you identify?
There's no horizon. There would be, yeah, but there's no horizon. Remember, so far we're just talking about the space inside this boundary. So yeah, if you included the outside, yeah, so if I take a piece of de Sitter, it's easier to see here, and I extend this all the way, then I would have a pole here and a pole here. That would be the two horizons you're talking about. And if I identified that with anything other than the correct period, I'd get a conical singularity there and there.
But because you cut it off, that doesn't happen.
But yeah, but my system, see, since I'm doing thermodynamics of the system inside my boundary, and that's only the gray area here. The part of the system outside, and there's the horizon, that's not part of the system. It's just not even, it's mathematically part of the solution to the constraints, but from the viewpoint of statistical mechanics, I'm just filling in my boundary with a system, and that's not part of it.
Actually, probably another source of confusion is the different ways you can analytically continue de Sitter as well, because again, what you've drawn on the left is more like a static patch.
That's correct.
And yet, when you analytically continue T of the static patch, you know, to get the S2, that's actually the global patch.
Yes.
The global de Sitter's are paraboloid, Lorentzian wise, so it's
if you continue the entire static patch with the appropriate variable being continued.
So I think that might be part of the reason I was getting confused. It's because it's a different time that's being analytically continued, I think,
yeah,
in each case.
I agree. But the physical conclusion here is correct, I think, that you could have hot de Sitter or cold de Sitter. Now, then the question arises, do you have it? So what does that mean? It means, what's the phase diagram of this system? So given these boundary conditions that define the ensemble, what configuration dominates it? Is it hot flat? Is it thermal de Sitter? Or is it something else? So what are the something else's it could be? So if the temperature is high enough, then another stationary point appears, which is a cosmological horizon solution, which is nothing but the part of the static patch outside the boundary instead of inside. Now, actually, if we're just solving the constraint equations of general relativity with a cosmological constant in spherical symmetry, it doesn't have to be just empty de Sitter here. There could be a black hole inside, and it could be Schwarzschild de Sitter. In fact, if we really take the viewpoint that the system is only what's outside, we could even allow a negative mass Schwarzschild de Sitter solution, which, if we did extend it inside, would have a naked singularity inside. Now that, Batul and I concluded we should not allow, because the whole idea of setting up this York boundary is that it's like a stand-in for a hypothetical reservoir that defines a certain thermal ensemble. And if we were to allow negative masses, black holes, sort of like solutions, it would be like we were saying our reservoir had an energy unbounded below, could have states of arbitrarily negative energy. And that led to basically what we considered as pathological behavior of the ensemble. So we decided to forbid that. So we only allow zero or positive Schwarzschild de Sitter solutions. Yeah.
Yeah, so curiously, you can find matter configurations, not with arbitrarily negative mass, but somewhat negative mass and de Sitter that are consistent with all of your favorite energy conditions.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, like domain walls, you know, they have a repulsive nature. So if I take a critical bubble, which does nothing to de Sitter, so I have like a domain wall filled with anti de Sitter, and I paste it into de Sitter space.
Okay.
And then I make it a little bit bigger than the critical bubble. That looks like a negative mass solution.
Mm-hmm.
Looks like negative mass Schwarzschild de Sitter.
Okay.
But it respects all of your favorite energy conditions.
And it's,
you can't make it arbitrarily big. So there's a bound on you know, being consistent with the energy conditions.
What determines how negative you can make it?
That's a good question. I have to remember those. Paper I wrote too many years ago for me to remember what the answer to that was, but there's a bound.
It would be interesting to include such membranes in the thermodynamic description, maybe.
Yeah.
The static, are they?
Yeah, you can make them static. Yeah. It's harder. You can make them dynamical really easy, but making them static is harder. You got to invent some weird stuff.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, if you want to Euclideanize it, you probably want them static.
Right.
To make it easy.
Okay, so that, yeah, this has a different topology because, so what's the topology of the Euclidean solution extended through time? Again, like Ruth was pointing out, this is just a spatial slice, but the Euclidean time goes around the horizon like this in an extra dimension. So each of these circles represents a two-sphere, let's say, if I were in four-dimensional space-time. And then I have an interval from the boundary to the horizon. But since that interval is wrapped around the horizon in a circle, I basically just get a disk, a two-disk, crossed with a two-sphere. That's pretty much standard topology, like you would have had for a black hole. So that's another configuration. And this can dominate at certain temperatures and sizes. And finally, if the temperature is even higher, you can have black hole stationary points of the action. And when they appear, they always appear in pairs. So there's a small black hole and a large one. This is very similar to what Whiting and York found just for the asymptotically flat case with the zero cosmological constant case with a York boundary. And the large one is stable, at least locally. The small one is always unstable. And just in case you're not aware of why it's stable, I just want to point out. So if this is in equilibrium with our bath at the boundary at a certain temperature, and a fluctuation sends a little bit of extra energy into the black hole, then the black hole would grow. And in asymptotically flat space, that leads to a runaway growth, because when it grows, the Hawking temperature goes down, at which point it's colder than the reservoir. So it absorbs even more and more and more, so it grows away. But when there's this boundary here, and this is what York first observed in that very early paper, when there's a boundary here, the black hole grows, yes, but the temperature of it is not being measured at infinity. What's relevant is the temperature at the location of the reservoir boundary. And since that is closer to the horizon of a bigger black hole, it's actually, the temperature is actually going up, not down, as measured locally at the boundary. And therefore, actually, it has a positive specific heat and a positive heat capacity, and it's stable. That was York's original observation. I think it's very similar to what happens in anti-de Sitter space, where the boundary is at infinity, but it still behaves the same way. Okay, so as I said, if your interest was this thermodynamics and nothing else, you would study the phase diagram with all these phases, compare the action for these different solutions for different values of the temperature and the boundary radius and figure out which phases dominate. And that's Batul and I did an exhaustive analysis of that in our paper, and I won't go into it now. I want to instead, for the rest of the talk, come back to the minus sign question and explain more concretely how to interpret that minus sign, and then talk about what's the meaning of the Gibbons and Hawking partition function just for de Sitter without any boundary. For both of those purposes, what we want to do is shrink our boundary to zero. So first, what is the first law of de Sitter space when we have a York boundary there? So we're adding the boundary to what Gibbons and Hawking did. So instead of the whole patch, we just have the part of the patch outside this boundary. So it's between there and the horizon. Spatial slice is called sigma. And the temperature times the entropy variation, Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of the horizon, is the variation of the Brown-York energy defined at this boundary. If you're not familiar with it, the Brown-York energy, it's a surface integral over the boundary of the extrinsic curvature of the boundary as embedded in the spatial slice with minus 1 over 8 pi g coefficient. And right, so there's a variation of that. If this had been inside out and it were a black hole and the boundary went to infinity, this would be the ADM mass variation. But then we also have minus delta E matter, or E matter is the integral of the stress energy tensor of matter contracted with the Killing vector of the background. And here I'm assuming there's no stress energy in the background. So I shouldn't have really written it this way. I should have written delta E matter and a delta there. So this is just the general, simple generalization of the first law when you have matter. But there's a minus sign here for exactly the reason that I explained earlier. You would have had the same minus sign in the black hole case, namely, of the entire Brown-York energy variation, only part of it is thermalized and is related to horizon entropy change. Part of it is just the fact that you change matter energy inside this gray region. That doesn't contribute to entropy unless it happens to be thermalized. So you should subtract it before equating to the horizon entropy change. Now, what we want to do is see what happens to that argument when we shrink the boundary. Okay, then algebraically, what happens? The surface integral for the Brown-York energy, its extrinsic curvature, which goes like 1 over the radius, integrated over an area, which in four-dimensional spacetime goes like radius squared. So this integral goes to zero proportional to the radius in four dimensions. And therefore, the Brown-York energy term just disappears. At the same time, the temperature, which could have been set arbitrarily here, actually becomes the Gibbons-Hawking temperature of de Sitter space, because when the radius goes to zero, that means that the location of the boundary is sitting in the middle of the static patch. And in order to have a stationary point of the action with that boundary, you have to, with a regular horizon with no conical singularity, you have to set the temperature equal to the Gibbons-Hawking temperature of de Sitter space. So this law reduces to what Gibbons and Hawking had derived. and explain, and I hope, or I think, this line of reasoning makes it completely sensible that there's a minus sign there.
Can I ask, so we are complete, you're assuming there's no Bessie entropy at this point, right?
Assuming there's no what?
Bessie entropy, or, so delta P, there's only delta SP at a black hole, right? So.
I don't think there's a black hole, actually, in that.
Can you go back to the
picture? Go back to
the, whoops.
Yeah, there's no, what's the, is that Bekenstein Hawking, or is that black
hole? Bekenstein Hawking, okay.
Right. Yeah, Bekenstein Hawking.
Maybe it should be called Hawking Bekenstein.
Or Gibbons Hawking. We considered calling it Gibbons Hawking entropy.
Yeah.
But
I thought Becken is the.
But I thought they're all Bekenstein entropies from my viewpoint.
GBH.
Okay, let's see. Right, so I want to now come back to the most pressing question, probably. Maybe I should have spent more time on it, but I think it's good to get the big picture here. What is the ensemble that Gibbons and Hawking got the answer to, you know, for the entropy, namely the area over four of the de Sitter static patch? So we want to consider the vanishing boundary limit of the Gibbons-Hawking path integral for the partition function. So once again, we shrink the boundary to zero. What happens to the partition function then? So it started out with the boundary as the trace of e to the minus inverse temperature times the Brown-York energy. I just explained that the Brown-York energy goes to zero when the boundary shrinks to zero. So whatever the temperature is, we get e to the zero, which is one. So we just get trace of the identity. So in this limit, the meaning of the partition function becomes nothing but the trace of the identity operator on some Hilbert space. What's the Hilbert space? It's the Hilbert space of states surrounded by a horizon, or in other words, just the states of a ball of space. Another way to look at this is in the microcanonical ensemble. You get the same result, apparently, because if instead of computing the partition function, we'd computed the density of states at a fixed value of the Brown-York energy, but then we take the limit where the boundary goes to zero, then the only value of the Brown-York energy that's possible is zero if the metric is not singular there. So if we're summing over all states with that value of the Brown-York energy, namely zero on a zero boundary, then we're just summing over all states. The density of states just becomes nothing but all the states in the Hilbert space. In fact, there's a technical point I think I'm going to gloss over here because I've gone too fast, but we could come back to later, as having to do with whether the path integral representation of this and this are identical or not. Maybe that's more for experts. Okay, so now I'm going to draw a picture of what this path integral domain is when I've shrunk the boundary to zero. At least this helps me understand it. So in order to picture it, because it's a higher dimensional sphere, I needed to apply a trick somehow. So what I'm going to do here is picture it in three dimensions, first of all. And even then, picturing a three-sphere is not easy. One way to do it is you just take all of three-dimensional space and you add a point at infinity, where all the points at infinity are identified. So that's what I'm doing here. So one spatial slice here would be a disk. And the disk is represented here by this half of a circle. Here's the horizon. And then all the points at infinity are identified. So this point is identified with all of those points and with that point. So this gray shaded area has the topology of a disk. And then the boundary, the system, the York boundary inside there is just like a circle. So we're talking about an annulus region outside of the boundary between there and the horizon. And then in the Euclidean stationary point topology, we rotate this disk around the horizon through 2 pi. And that turns this picture into a ball into a ball, a three-dimensional ball, but with all the points on its surface identified, and that's a three-sphere. So all to say that the partition function we start with in the Euclidean or near the Euclidean saddle is over a manifold, which is a three-sphere with a donut cut out of it, because you know, we're not including the part inside the boundary, and that's wrapped on a circle around the horizon. So the surface of that, well, that's like a solid torus cut out of a three-sphere. Now we shrink down R to zero, and the solid torus just becomes a loop. And we're supposed to restrict to boundary conditions such that the Brown-York we're supposed to weight configurations by e to the minus beta h, but h is zero, h being the Brown-York energy. So they're all weighted the same way. And the fact that we had this boundary just disappears from the discussion. So what we're doing then is looking for stationary points of the Euclidean action on a sphere topology space. And if there's more than one, we want the one with the smallest action. So let's talk about the action. The action for the Euclidean Einstein-Hilbert action with a cosmological constant on a solution is minus the cosmological constant times the volume of the solution. So we want the solution with the small, with the largest volume in order to get the smallest action. Now, it's not known in four-dimensional spacetime whether there are solutions other than the round four-sphere. But actually, in higher dimensions, particular 5 to 9, an infinite number of solutions to the Euclidean Einstein equation with a cosmological constant are known. So we have to ask which one of them, if any, is the correct one to approximate the path integral. It's possible to argue that the round sphere has the largest volume of all of them. So it would always dominate, and therefore, the partition function would be given by exponential of the area of the round four sphere divided by 4h bar g, and that's the Gibbons-Hawking result. The interpretation of it is that this exponential is the dimension of the Hilbert space of all states surrounded by a horizon, or in other words, all states of a ball in de Sitter space. Well, not de Sitter space, of a ball in gravity with a cosmological constant. And what is de Sitter space in this calculation? It's nothing but the saddle point. It has a certain size. That size determines the temperature. We didn't put the temperature in. And it also determines the dimension of the Hilbert space. Okay. Now the last part, I hope it's okay if I go over a little bit,
sure,
is to generalize this to beyond de Sitter space, to any ball in space. Suppose I take the limit where the cosmological constant goes to zero. Then this saddle point we're talking about, L goes to infinity, and the entropy goes to infinity. So in the case of a Einstein gravity without a cosmological constant, the dimension of the Hilbert space of states of a ball is infinite. To make something sensible that's finite to think about, we should restrict the size of the ball somehow, and then count the states. So how should we restrict the size? The first thing that Manus and I tried, whoops.
You have a little message in the middle.
Maybe it's a later.
But I can't get rid of it on this screen.
Oh, it's a difference? Oh, okay.
Uh-oh. How do I get back to the other screen?
Okay, just
do slideshow.
Just slideshow.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's the one.
Yeah, so the first thing we thought of was restricting the area of it, because that's a natural thing to do. That doesn't work, because if you put in a constraint of that you're only considering topological balls with a certain surface area, that constraint ends up acting like a membrane source in the Einstein equation. And a membrane introduces a conical deficit or excess. And so then we're looking for solutions to the to the Einstein equation on a four sphere, let's say, topology, which don't exist. If you have a conical deficit on a sphere surface, maybe they exist, but we think they don't. So basically, we think there's no saddle point at all if we fix the area. And I think the physical interpretation might be the following. If you fix to states that have a definite area, then the variable conjugate to the area is infinitely uncertain. But the variable conjugate to area of a horizon is the boost angle in the Rindler, in the Minkowski plane normal to the horizon. So it's like maybe the geometries are just, there's too much quantum fluctuation, so there's no saddle. I don't know if that's the right answer, but in any case, we couldn't find a saddle. So instead, we fixed the spatial volume. And that works. So that's the last part. How do you fix the spatial volume? We're going to define a partition function with potentially a cosmological constant, but that could be zero, and a fixed spatial volume. We're going to integrate over metrics. Now I'm using just the formal Euclidean expression for the path integral, but it should be understood as just something we're going to use near the saddle to evaluate the partition function. So we integrate over Lagrange multiplier lambda, which is a function of an angle variable theta. So we foliate our sphere topology by an angle that goes around the horizon. And for each value of it, we take the difference between the spatial volume of that ball and our fixed volume V, and then multiply that by the corresponding Lagrange multiplier. So this term in the action enforces the restriction that we have foliated our sphere by balls all of the same volume. So this means that what we're computing is physically the dimension of the Hilbert space of states of quantum gravity of balls with all the same volume.
Why is there an extrinsic curvature term?
Why would there be?
Well, why wouldn't there be? You could include one.
Oh, wait, you mean from a boundary?
Yeah.
There's no boundary. So the topology here is this. We have a ball whose surface is going to be the horizon, and then we like rotate that through the extra dimension around the horizon, and it forms a topology of a sphere with no boundary.
It's no boundary.
No boundary. So this term is a source, creates a source term in the Einstein equation. And I'll skip the detail, but it has an effective stress energy tensor that's lambda divided by the lapse function for this scalar field, just the norm of the gradient of phi. And so it looks like a perfect fluid stress energy tensor, except the energy density is zero. Gamma AB is just the spatial metric here of our ball. So looking for a saddle that's a stationary point that's independent of phi, that's like looking for a static solution to the Einstein equation with a perfect fluid source, spherical symmetry. That should sound familiar. It's what you do when you solve for a star and use the Tolman-Oppenheimer-Volkoff equation. And that's exactly what we have to solve here. It's just a Euclidean version of it and with zero energy density.
Phi, is that
yeah, it's the Euclidean time. So the solution looks like the following. The metric is just of this form. There's this lapse function that's a function of radius. H is one if the cosmological constant is zero, and it's just this de Sitter form if the cosmological constant is non-zero. And then N is determined by the TOV equation, as I said, and let me just skip to the metric form. It looks like this. So this is our saddle. This is what would have been, in the de Sitter case, a round sphere. It's not a round sphere. Let me show you what it looks like. Here's an embedding diagram to try to illustrate what this geometry looks like. So if we neglect the angles and just look at the radius phi subspace. If we were talking about de Sitter, it would just be a hemisphere that's shown by this dotted line like that. But for our geometry, it's this other sort of shape. This is a embedding in Euclidean three-dimensional space, the induced metric agrees with this metric in the phi R subspace. And R here represents the proper distance along the surface of this shape. And then the angle part, well, for every value of R, you've got a sphere of radius R. And this is plotting like an equator of those spheres. In the De Sitter case, it would just be a conical embedding diagram. But in our case, it kind of flares out like that, where each sphere corresponds to the radius that measures distance along the surface there. OK, now there's a subtlety I have to confront. Well, what's the value of the action, first of all? Did I say that? Because that's.
Does R and E always have to be larger than the L? Could it be smaller? Or some preventing?
Yeah, it could certainly be smaller. L could go to infinity.
So you could have that little Dunn's cap thing inside R equals L as well as out?
Yes.
And there's a different interpretation there, or?
Yeah, so what we did here to make the comparison is we took, we matched the two, the De Sitter case and our case, to have the same period at the center of the patch, so the same temperature. And that's why it ended up being outside. But we could have actually had one inside also. And there's nothing qualitatively different. There is a maximum volume, as I'll say. So actually, I could say right now, if you have a non-zero cosmological constant, then of course De Sitter space exists and has a certain volume for the whole spatial section. If we chose our V to be bigger than an entire cross-section of De Sitter space, there would be no saddle at all. Because you can't fit a volume that big into De Sitter space. So that's where that comes in. Okay, so the action of this gives area over 4. Which is exactly what we would expect by analogy with De Sitter. But there is a catch. You might notice by just looking at the shape, it's kind of pointy there at the top of the dunce cap. And in fact, it's singular. This metric has a curvature singularity that blows up like 1 over r minus rv. So 1 over the proper distance to the tip. You might have thought, well, that's going to be a problem. The action will blow up. But it doesn't. This divergence is sufficiently weak that the action is finite and gives the area over 4, or minus it. But it does raise the question, if there's an infinite curvature, are we justified in using general relativity with only the Einstein-Hilbert term in the action? And we consider that carefully. And because I've gone on really long, I think I won't give you the argument. I'll just give you the upshot. If you look at the corrections you would get to the entropy, under the hypothesis that there are higher order terms in the action and that the curvature saturates when this term in the term in the equations of motion coming from this becomes comparable to the Einstein-Hilbert term. So if we assume that the higher curvature terms regulate this divergence somehow, then in fact, they regulate it, but they don't affect the entropy except in a very suppressed way. So we claim that the calculation is consistent within effective field theory, provided the higher curvature terms do regulate somehow the divergence. We don't show that they regulate it. And that's it. I just want to conclude. I mentioned positive lambda. I'll skip that. Just to conclude with a few remarks. So first of all, there's something very strange about what I told you, I think. Namely, the Hilbert space dimension that we compute sort of non-perturbatively from this path integral gives A over 4. But that's also the entropy that's normally attributed to a semi-classical static patch of De Sitter space, just the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of the horizon in a semi-classical setting. So why should the total dimension of Hilbert space be equal to the entropy that you see when you're just looking at a semi-classical configuration? The only answer I can think of is that it's because almost all the states, overwhelmingly, are the near horizon microstates that are the same no matter how the space-time is excited otherwise. And therefore, you're already capturing at the semi-classical level in the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, at leading order, the entire dimension of the Hilbert space. This is precisely what Banks and Fischler were proposing, which I thought sounded wrong initially to me, but I think this line of reasoning supports their proposal. And it also supports that Banks-Fiol-Morrissey proposal that excited states, the fact that the entropy goes down when you excite de Sitter space, could only then be understood as the statement that by quote unquote exciting de Sitter space, what you're really doing is constraining the states in the Hilbert space to the ones that have a particular kind of excitation in them, and thereby not counting the full dimension. Two other comments. If we include matter fields, which I didn't discuss yet, obviously the Hilbert space would be bigger, right? Because you have matter field degrees of freedom in addition to gravitational. So how does that affect the analysis? And this goes to the same thing I mentioned earlier about the value of Newton's constant. I think that the fact that you have more degrees of freedom in the microscopic scale would basically affect the value of G, and an A over 4G would still give the correct entropy. This is just the old species problem for black hole entropy in another setting. Well, solution to the species problem. And finally, a few years ago, I proposed this maximal vacuum entanglement hypothesis that if you compare balls in the vacuum of a given volume to balls in a state near the vacuum, by vacuum, I mean a semi-classical vacuum state, all states at a given volume other than the vacuum would have smaller entropy. In other words, the vacuum has the most entropy. This line of reasoning kind of supports that, because when I did that work, I just fixed the volume in an ad hoc way. But here, we're calculating the dimension of the Hilbert space of balls at fixed volume, and we also get the area over 4. But if the interpretation of that is that's the full dimension of the Hilbert space, and it's equal to the semi-classical entropy of the empty vacuum state, then it must be also true that any other state corresponds to a constrained state and has less entropy. There are less degrees of freedom active. So I'm not going to say this proves it, because I think there's some serious subtleties here, but it supports that. And I should end there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ted. Questions?
I have a question, if I can. So you mentioned at a certain point how what you did for the Sitter, you could just take the cosmological constant to zero and then just say that's just a feature of gravity itself, not that the Sitter. I would hardly call myself an expert in this area, but one thing I learned, and the thing I learned is that the cosmological horizon is observer dependent, so you can move toward the horizon that bounce back, and that's very specific of the Sitter. Does that anywhere factor in your analysis?
In the case when we have a boundary, before we shrink it to zero, the boundary is locating us at a specific place. So you could say this is the horizon for the observer at that boundary. And I think it's completely consistent with what you're saying. But when we shrink the boundary to zero and end up calculating just the dimension of the Hilbert space, it seems like the location of the observer is not part of the story anymore. There is no observer. And it just becomes a calculation of all states of quantum gravity of a ball that's bounded by a horizon, or in other words, a causal domain of dependence. I find this really curious and maybe profound. Cosmological constant has the interpretation of setting the dimension of the Hilbert space of quantum gravity without picking any particular observer. It's true that if you embed this ball in a semi-classical spacetime, it's only going to be half of, it'll be a de Sitter static patch, which has a antipodal side, and together they'll make a full sphere. But because of de Sitter symmetry, you could have put that ball anywhere in de Sitter space. So the calculation is just independent of where you place the ball. That's the way I interpret it.
Thank you.
Yes, there are two questions.
So Tom and I spent a lot of time way back when, in that 06 time, when I was a grad student in Santa Cruz, thinking about these membrane solutions where you connect two different de Sitter spaces and what that means for this interpretation of, you know, finite number of, you know, identifying, you know, this partition function with the log and the number of degrees of freedom, right? So have you thought at all about that? Because there's some really interesting implications, right? You know, if you have your de Sitter as the false vacuum and you decay into a true vacuum that's a lower de Sitter,
mm-hmm.
or Minkowski or anti-de Sitter,
mm-hmm.
and you can make all sorts of arguments based on, you know, like what's the causal diamond you can draw with maximal, you know, area. For example, if you decay to, you know, Minkowski space true vacuum, then your causal diamond can be, you know, infinite.
Mm-hmm.
You can see all of the de Sitter space from whence you nucleated. Well, not all of it, right? But you can see far bigger than the static patch, right?
Right.
And so then, what are the, you know, so how should I then interpret this this statement? Is it, you know, in these theories that allow multiple vacua, you know, do I count the number of degrees of freedom associated with the smallest cosmological constant? That seems to be kind of where it pushes you. But it'd be really interesting to think about that in this context where you're being more precise than I think we were. it was a lot of words and just toy examples.
I agree. It sounds very interesting because transitions where the membrane disappears or appears, or the effective cosmological constant changes, are transitions where different numbers of degrees of freedom are coming into play or changing.
Right.
But how is it that that happens? I agree, that's very interesting. Are there papers or a paper about what?
Yeah, send your email with some.
Please do that.
But I mean, the implications, like, so in the context we were thinking is kind of, you know, the landscape where, should I really think of, you know, what is the microscopic theory underlying this? Does it have
right.
a finite number of degrees of freedom,
mm-hmm.
or infinite number of degrees of freedom? And I mean, that makes a lot of difference for how you interpret things like internal inflation.
Right. The only reference point I have, which is probably not a very good one, is how in ADS-CFT, the cosmological constant is related to, even though it's got the opposite sign, related to the number of D-brains in some stringy-like configuration. But there, at least, there's a counting of some, you can identify physical degrees of freedom that somehow determine the cosmological constant. So I would guess maybe it's similar that there's an embedding theory in which de Sitter space is just a sector with a certain number of active degrees of freedom that can change in a sufficiently drastic phase transition.
Anyway, really like to discuss with you while
you're here. Yeah, great. I would.
Maybe there's a question. So.
Have you thought about the physical meaning of this fluid which has pressure and no density?
No. It's just purely mathematical result of constraining the volume. So we're looking for a constrained saddle. There's something called constrained instantons. This is an example of it. Where you just, for one, some physical reason, you're interested in whether there's a stationary point subject to some constraint. In our case, we want the volume to be fixed, so it ends up changing the saddle point condition in that, by that effective fluid.
But you get these classical space times.
Yeah.
Which effectively have a fluid in them. And
yeah.
I mean, the question is...
But it's not a physical fluid. It's just the answer to the question, what geometry dominates the... Okay, wait, you're going to say, if that's a saddle geometry, is it actually recognizable in the ensemble?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, as some kind of a physical configuration. I don't think so, because remember, we by hand put in that we're fixing the volume. It's not like some physical condition fixed it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an answer to a count of a Hilbert space dimension. That's not, you're not going to find it when you go in nature and you look.
But you showed there's some physical significance to fixing the volume. And
well, we just wanted some way to refer to a particular size, quote unquote. Otherwise, we'd get an infinite entropy. I suspect there's a deeper relation between volume and quantum gravity, but I don't know what it is.
There is no degree of freedom in it, right? Propagating degree of freedom.
In the volume, right. I mean, there's volume equals complexity conjecture.
Mm. So that's 4 volume.
Or, well, no, spatial, also 3 volume. Spatial volume. Yeah, that occurred to me. Maybe it's somehow like we're fixing the complexity and then computing the entropy, but.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. We have actually solutions like you do, but with the black hole and fluids that have pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And you conjecture this could be related to dark energy. But, I mean, at a mathematical level.
Dark energy without any energy density?
Well, that pressure that you hesitate to assign significance to it. We said that could be pressure of dark energy, but that's...
Right. Oh, I see. You could do it without energy density, just with pressure, you mean?
Well, that's part of the...
Dark pressure. Dark tension is what
dark
it should
pressure.
Be. Dark tension, because it's got to be negative pressure.
Yeah, and it does have... Anyway, so you can...
Yeah, actually, I thought, you know, dark energy should be called dark tension,
mm-hmm.
but it would sound too ominous.
Yes, it sounds like Star Wars.
At a certain point.
Okay, maybe we could stop here, and thanks again.
Thank you.